Hello, I'm Fred Kowal, president of United University Professions, and this is The Voice.
I am a voice. I am a union. I am the sign of 100,000 workers strong. I am a voice. I am a clarion call. We are united.
The Voice podcast is a production of United University Professions, the nation's largest higher education union. Representing more than 42,000 academic and professional faculty and retirees at state-operated SUNY campuses and public teaching hospitals in Brooklyn, Stony Brook, and Syracuse. This episode was recorded on Friday, May 13th, a day before the horrific mass shooting in Buffalo. The Voice podcast will address the issues of racism and racist violence as a national crisis in our next episode.
Our guest today is Dr. Nuala Magan Drescher, UUP's first and only, thus far, only woman president. She served two terms as UUP president from 1981 to 1987. During her tenure as UUP president, Dr. Drescher took on a Cuomo, the first Cuomo, fought tirelessly to save SUNY jobs, and saw through the ratification of not one, but two contracts between UUP and the state of New York. Dr. Drescher is Distinguished Service Professor Emerita at the State University of New York College at Buffalo. Drescher oversaw the overwhelming ratification of 2 3-year contracts with the state, with across-the-board salary increases that ranged from 5% to 9%. Those contracts also created what is now the UUP-SUNY Joint Labor Management Committees. One of those programs, the Dr. Nuala Magan Drescher Diversity and Inclusion Leave Program, is named for her and has had a dramatic impact on the careers of women and those who come from communities of color. As UUP president, Nuala was a fierce fighter for UUP. She stood up to Governor Mario Cuomo, who, in his first state budget after his 1983 election, drastically cut SUNY funding and proposed cutting more than 3,000 SUNY jobs in the process. She called Cuomo's budget, quote, a recipe for the destruction of SUNY, and launched UUP's Save SUNY campaign, staging rallies and press conferences, forming coalitions with students, unions, and supporters, and pressing legislators to restore the governor's cuts. Nuala also defended UUP members against attacks on tenure and academic freedom, and grew the union's political advocacy efforts, increasing legislative support for funding for SUNY. Dr. Drescher is also a researcher and a historian. She is co-author of United University Professions, Pioneering in Higher Education Unionism, and also Engineer for the Public Good, A History of the Buffalo District U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Nuala Drescher has been one of UUP's most influential leaders and voices, and I am happy and honored to have her on this, our first episode of The Voice podcast. Nuala, welcome.
Thank you very much, Fred. I hardly recognize myself.
Well, you know, sometimes that's how it is. When someone is talking about a career, I've experienced the same thing. And I want to start with your career first as a scholar, as an academic. And I'd like to hear your experience of what it was like to enter academia as a woman and a scholar when it was still rather rare. And thus, you were breaking new ground as an historian. So could you tell us a little bit about what that was like?
Particularly in history, which is my field. I was the first female Hagley Fellow at the University of Delaware. I was the first woman to get a PhD in the humanities at the University of Delaware. In fact, I got my PhD the same day Joe Biden got his bachelor's degree at the same conferring ceremonies. It was not easy. It really wasn't. Scholarship was rough. It was individualistic. And the standards for women were a lot higher than they were for men. Now, that never bothered me because it just made me work harder and have more fun. Scholarship was fun to me. Eventually, I ended up, however, being a labor historian rather than things that I was primarily oriented to, because I fell in love with the Brewery Workers Union when I was doing my dissertation, which was a study of opposition to prohibition. And it was through my scholarship that I ended up being sort of an outlier in my family. I'm the only person who's a registered Democrat. Everybody else are, well, MAGA people, which makes me very sad. But the scholarship and the education that I've had moved me away from that kind of rigidity that I inherited. And it led me into unionism. In one sense, I was present at the creation. 1968, when the Taylor Law was passed, I was the chapter president at Buffalo State of AAUP, American University Professions. And Sam Wachtel, who was my predecessor as president of UUP, was my vice president. And we said, hey, the Taylor Law is passed. We got to go into collective bargaining. And AAUP said, oh, no, 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 that's unprofessional. And so Sam and I resigned, and the rest is history.
And when UUP was getting started, what were those early days like for you and for the others who really were the founding parents, as I call them, of UUP?
It wasn't easy because, one, academia is an individualistic profession. You're a self-starter. The idea of collective action is not something that comes naturally to those of us in the academic world. Even professionals who had a union relationship, let's say they were technicians who belonged to the Actors Guild or the musicians, that was for that life, not for my university life. So that was number one. Number two, we had a whole lot of people who were beneficiaries of the GI Bill, either because of service in the Second World War or the Korean War, who left their union ties behind when they got their degrees. And they were not eager to go back to being blue-collar, lunch-pail types. So that was, you know, very, very difficult. Third problem was the university was brand new. It was barely 30 years old. Everybody identified with Cobleskill or Buffalo State or Westbury. You didn't identify with SUNY. There was no culture of devotion to the system. And yet the state said it's a system. And so we had to, you know, deal with that. Then there was the fundamental rivalry between the National Education Association and the AFT, which was just a sad waste of money because we basically have the same objective, which is advancing the interests of the members. So all of those factors were there. And then add the fact that people had gotten into governance for the first time, and they were experimenting with that. And that enhanced their hostility to unions. So we faced hostility from the NEA, hostility from governance, and just plain entropy, as well as union hostility. So when I became president, we had maybe 9,000 members out of a unit of 7,500. No, 17,500. Right. Sorry. It was not easy, believe me. The hostility was there. The entropy was there. And all that had to be overcome.
You know, and it points to challenges that unions face today to a large extent because of so much that has happened over the past decades, really going back to even prior to that in the 1950s and 1960s. I wonder, as you thought about your role in UUP and in unions, when was the moment, if there was a moment, when you decided that you could be the leader of this relatively new union facing these challenges? What was it that inspired you to want to do this and made you feel like you could do a really good job?
Well, it was a complicated decision-making process. I was just finishing my book on the Army Corps of Engineers, and that had been a joy, spending time in the National Archives, going through the records of the engineers who were the first unit in the United States Army to really become professional. And we had the fight with the NEA, and I got deeply involved in protecting the AFT's interest in that. But we also had a split in UUP between two perfectly legitimate poles, but mutually exclusive in some very real ways. On the one hand, we had the United Caucus, which is where I was, which was very practically oriented and started with the premise that our primary function is collective bargaining and service to the members, the dues-paying members. Now, since many of our dues-paying members are interested in such things as foreign policy, like will we support the war against Russia in Ukraine, but that's not the primary purpose of the organization. We agree to go along with those kind of things because that's service to the members' values. But the primary purpose is going to the table, negotiating a 988 contract, a 5% contract, or whatever we can get, and then implementing that contract. Implementation is the secret. I mean, I can remember one of my colleagues, Manny Freed from Buff State, who used to say, who was a real labor activist, who used to say, even a bad contract can be valuable if you implement it properly, if you do it with vigor and commitment. On the other hand, you had the so-called Reform Caucus, which put the social justice objectives as their top priority. And United Caucus, they were secondary, but in the Reform Caucus, they were primary. So when it came time to make a decision, because we had term limits and Sam Marshall couldn't run for re-election, we were looking for a candidate. And so since nobody else stepped forward, I said, okay, I think it's time we try. Now, I had no expectation of winning because, A, there had been a lot of hostility developed towards Sam, and I was from his campus, and I was also a woman. And in our own organization, there was a, shall we say, less than enthusiastic commitment to equity for women. I think I carried the delegate assembly by 3 votes.
Really?
2 of which I still don't know where came from because I had done a vote count.
Yep.
And I figured I'd win by 1 vote. And I won by 3. I think it was 3. But there were at least two votes that I to this day have not been able to figure out where they came from. And it was an interesting, shall we say, an interesting experience.
With that kind of I wasn't aware the election was that close.
Oh, yeah.
So obviously your first challenge is to bring together a right. badly divided delegate assembly and membership. How did you do it?
By coalition building. Several of the Reform Caucus people said, hey, we'll support the elimination of term limits if you appoint us to be chairman of this committee and that committee and another committee. I said, that's a good, interesting idea. However, I don't operate that way. So what I did was I systematically took their second rank people, not the key leaders, but I put them on the committees, not as chairman, but put them on the committees. Within a year, they were saying to their leadership, she's not so bad. What are you telling me that she's a tyrant? We're on the committees. We're seeing that these things work. I also changed the way we did negotiating. Instead of getting a professional negotiator to be the chief negotiator, I picked Tim Riley, who was sort of in our caucus, but sort of a leader in his own way, to be the chief negotiator, because I believe that the chief spokesman for collective bargaining outcomes should be somebody who would be bound by the contract just like everybody else. That was a real innovation. It was a real departure. In order to deal with the accusations that people were playing games with money, we created what I called the budget book, so that every line in our budget had an explanation in the budget book. And so when somebody got up and, you know, would rail, we would be there till 4 o'clock in the morning sometimes over these budget issues. Tom Matthews, who was my treasurer, and how he got to be treasurer is another story, he would say, well, turn to page 24. There's a full explanation of that. Turn to page 79. I mean, this budget book was like an inch thick the first three or four times that we did it. And by the third or fourth year, people began to trust. So that fear disappeared. You talk about how Tom Matthews got to be the treasurer. We elected our offices in staggered years. So the treasurer was elected a year after I was elected. Bad idea, because you have to have a team. But Joe Drew, may he rest in peace, was so militantly anti-abortion that when the AFT endorsed Roe versus Wade, he resigned. And so we were stuck with no treasurer. Now, Tom had a lot of experience as a treasurer, and he proved to be a very, very valuable asset, I was very, very grateful.
And had a remarkable career.
Yes, he did.
As vice president for professionals, and then also he was chief negotiator.
I know he was.
Very effective. He was chief when I was on the team. You know, and it's interesting because I think that revolutionary approach of saying someone from the bargaining unit will actually be the voice at the table, I think makes us stronger. It's throughout my entire career in UUP and in SUNY, that's how it's always been. And I almost took it as a given.
Nope.
So it's fascinating to see how it developed. But crucial, I, as president, really depend on that chief negotiator to be the person whom I can trust.
Absolutely.
To be at that table. And then we are partners. I mean, that partnership is so vitally important.
Well,
as you saw.
I was very fortunate because I had two, more than two, but focus on two. One was Paul Martin from Buff State, who took shorthand notes of all of the negotiations tables. So he would go to his room after the negotiations and he would type them up and then distribute them to everybody. And the state could not understand how we could repeat exactly what they had said the previous day or the previous week. They didn't realize that Paul was taking shorthand notes, which was, you know, extremely, extremely valuable. And we also had who's the person who's we have the award for activism?
Nina Mitchell.
Nina Mitchell. Nina Mitchell was an extraordinary woman. She was a recovered a drug user who became a counselor and took degrees in psychology. So she would read body language.
Oh, fantastic.
Which was just unbelievable because she could spot and warn by sending a note down the table. The other thing that I think is important is I never went to the table. In fact, it's the one experience in this union that I have never had was actually negotiating at the table. But that's important because when the chief negotiator reaches an impasse, he has to say, oh, I have to talk to my principal.
That's right.
And so it breaks the tempo, and it was proved to be very, very effective.
And what works well, or at least was in my experience in the contract we had back in 2016, 2017, took a couple of years, and now as we go to the table, is I think the state has an understanding, or maybe it's just we've been fortunate. It was your experience. It was my experience. That the state understands that it's not a case where we as presidents are behind the scenes controlling every step of the way, and that chief negotiator is just a mouthpiece. No, they are authorized to do negotiating. Otherwise, we would never get anywhere.
But our Constitution is very clear.
It certainly is.
The president is responsible for negotiation.
That's right.
Now, I did have a very interesting experience with that.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. The last contract that I was responsible for, we almost went to impasse. And the state's director of employee relations said, we've gone as far as we can go. Give us a list of what you absolutely have to have some motion on. Otherwise, we're going to just break off negotiations. So I went to the team and I said, I'm the president. The contract is my responsibility. Give me the list of things that you absolutely have. Well, then I had to go one-on-one with the GOER director. We took at that in his office. One deal was $8 million. We made a breakthrough on part-timers that got them their term contracts for the first time.
Oh, excellent.
Part-timers are a real serious issue, and we've been working on that since I had the first conference of part-times. But we were at the 11th hour, 1 minute to midnight, and I've got motions on everything except one. The one I couldn't get the state to move on was minimum salaries. But since we only had four people in the entire unit who were below the minimum, I figured that was one I could compromise
on. Exactly. Yeah. But those are, last time out, what I was concerned about was attacks on the health benefits that we've been able to get for part-timers. Because it's very expensive for the state.
Extremely.
But it is such a vitally important benefit. And those were really difficult parts of those negotiations because the state was not willing to sign off without some kind of concessions. I wanted a contract that had none. We ended up with some slight concessions on that while maintaining for the vast majority of our part-timers what they need.
See, what the state does not understand is that some of these things like part-time benefits are recruiting tools.
Exactly.
That, these part-time people could go to Duville or to wherever, Ithaca College. Instead, they come to SUNY and enhance and enrich the things that we can, offer.
Exactly.
It's the same thing with the Drescher Fellowships. People go to the hiring meetings and they say, hey, we've got a deal here. Is it we can get you to come in your sixth or seventh year. You can have a year off to do work. Oh,
exactly.
Interesting. So that creative mutual works out very well.
Right. There is a mutuality of interest in labor management and in labor management relationship. I think In my experiences, I had to deal with the younger Cuomo. And there was a stark difference, obviously. And I'd like you to speak about your experience working with Governor Mario Cuomo, in that the sense that I had from Andrew Cuomo and unfortunately the folks in SUNY at the time was there was not an appreciation for the importance of the mutuality of interests that we have. And with that, Governor Hochul in her State of the State talked about how important it will be to recruit and retain highly qualified faculty and professional staff in SUNY. We couldn't agree more. It's going to take resources to do that. And so I'm a little more optimistic as we work with Governor Hochul, but I want to pivot back to your experiences with Mario Cuomo, which was such a dominant figure in New York State politics, and you had to deal with his dealing with the budget crisis while at the same time negotiating with his administration. What was working with Mario Cuomo like?
Well, first of all, I was singularly fortunate in having to deal with the chancellor that we had. He and I, when we first met, looked at each other and said, "Don't I know you?" Cliff Wharton. "Oh," I said, "you were vice president for academics of the National Students Association." He said, "And you were president of the Met New York region of the National Students Association." So here we were, two NSAers who had met at national meetings, and he was a very decent and ethical person. He understood the situation. His job was to make sure that SUNY continued as a system rather than as a balkanized individuals. When I first became president, the governor was Kerry. And I had not really, until I did the book, appreciated just how grim the financial situation. I mean, I knew it was bad, but looking at the grimness of the situation by reading the biography of Kerry and the things that he faced, it came home anew just how serious. You had the city bankruptcy, the state taking over the full cost of the City University of New York, a hostile administration in Washington, a hostile Congress that didn't want to do anything to help New Yorkers.
Right.
I mean, it really was a very bad situation. And then Kerry did not run for re-election, and Cuomo came in. Now, Mario Cuomo was a very interesting person. He was a philosophically oriented person. The values that he had were my values. We come from a very similar background. He's Italian, I'm Irish, but it's the same situation. He understood delegation, and he delegated the negotiations to his governor's office of employee relations. The first contract I was responsible for was hell. It was awful because we had the problem of the state financial situation, and you had a lot of egos involved in GOER. Again, they're new. This is only 20-year experience. We almost went to impasse. It was very difficult. In spite of the fact that we had negotiated 9-8-8 in a 3-year contract percentage increases. But the hate between our people and their people was just almost indescribable. What saved the day was the labor management committees, in which, if people don't understand how they work, you have 6 or 5 or whatever of each side. You have to have 100% agreement. One side can veto the ideas of the other. Now, who wants to throw away free money to address problems? And so consequently, you begin to dialogue. You begin to dialogue. And putting people on those labor management committees who understood the practical orientation of things, who understood the definition of compromise, and then the state followed through. And so you began almost immediately a cooperative attitude. It was really quite remarkable. If we had not had those labor management committees, I don't know what the rest of my 3-year term would have been. It wouldn't have been pretty.
Exactly. How did you keep the members with you in that contract fight? Because that's always a challenge. We've all faced that, right?
It wasn't easy, particularly when we had to agree to the lag pay. That created a real problem. I understood why the state wanted it, because they had to recover when somebody left the payroll. They'd been paid for work they didn't do. We handled the problem, I think, very cleverly. I got a phone call from my sister, who worked for the state on Long Island, and she said, "I don't have any money to buy hot dogs for the kids this weekend." And I said, "Why?" She said, "Well, because the lag payroll, I got paid last Friday, and I won't get paid until Monday." I said, "Our people are not going to."
Yeah.
Except we had a lot, particularly in our professional ranks.
Yes.
So what we did was we withheld the increase in pay for professionals and academics until, in the bank, theoretically, the amount of money that would have been the two-week lag had been accrued. When people began to see that kind of sensitivity to the members' needs, they began to be not enthusiastic, but less hostile. The big thing, however, was political involvement. Now, that started when Sam Walkshall created the first Save SUNY campaign in the Kerry administration. And then we picked it up because we didn't want to lose 8,000 jobs, which was predicted. We systematically met with our legislators. We educated them to what was going on in their particular district. We did analysis of how much the existence of the institution meant in the community. And we did everything conceivable. And again, I was singularly fortunate, and I had an advisor, Morris Budin, may he rest in peace, who was a sharp economist. And he was able to do these things in his head. I mean, he was just incredible. Again, it didn't create a whole lot of activism, but it did create less hostility and, in fact, hospitality to what was going on. So we got good turnouts in favor of our contract negotiations. We never had a problem recruiting people to come in on Tuesdays and Wednesdays to actually meet with the legislators. It became a regular ritual. And we even began to make contributions to the NYSED AFT vote COPE,
right,
which was hard to believe that our people would actually contribute. Now, you didn't win everybody. I remember one time I'm sitting in my office and the phone rings and somebody said, "Will you take this call from Stony Brook?" I said, "Well, sure. It's a member, right?" "Yeah." Well, a person said, "You'd support Adolf Hitler if he was for SUNY." I had written a letter in response to a member of the assembly whom I never would have voted for.
Mm-hmm.
Because of his attitude towards women, his attitude towards a whole lot of other things that are important in my life. But he had saved 5 jobs at the hospital at Stony Brook. He had responded to a crisis over toxic waste that was being handled badly. And he said to me, "I need your members to know this." So I wrote a letter saying so-and-so was very helpful in saving jobs. And I didn't say I would vote for him.
Right, right.
But that, you know, see, you run into, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I remember, what was his name? He was from Syracuse, senior member of the Senate, who was on NYSED's veto list because he was opposed to agency fee. He was opposed to a whole lot of things that were, but he saved 24 jobs at Upstate Medical Center. And he sent his chief staff person to me and said, "You know, I have every endorsement in the state of New York from the farmers, from the urban people. The only one I can't get is the endorsement from the teachers." I said, "Well, you're opposed to agency fee, which is a breaker. You're pro vouchers, which is a breaker. But I said, you have done super stuff for me and for my people, so I will go to the NYSED endorsement meeting and ask them to endorse it." Well, I don't think Ray Skuse and company have ever forgiven me. I got up and I gave one of my speeches and the endorsement carried.
Really?
But again, that you have to represent your members.
Right.
And this, when somebody does something that you ask them to do, you have to support.
Exactly.
In return, even if you think you'll fail, because sometimes you win.
Yeah, yeah. And at my initial experience in UUP was those Tuesday advocacy days. That was how I got
my
start.
That's right. Cobleskill was Tuesday.
Yes.
Buff State was Wednesday.
And, you know, that's something that has, since your presidency, has always been a major emphasis point. And one of the struggles, I want to ask you about where we are now. One of the biggest struggles that we have faced, and certainly that I have faced as president, is it seems like we are at a point where we desperately could use a chancellor like Wharton, because there is so much of the balkanization of SUNY. It is, you know, the university centers at Buffalo and Stony Brook are now calling themselves flagship universities to be treated totally differently. And when we advocate with legislators, it has reached the point where legislators will care very much about their own campuses, which is totally understandable because of the economic impact. But unlike with CUNY, where the system is there within the city, SUNY is scattered across the state. And legislators rarely see it as a system. And unfortunately, the struggle for chancellors has been trying to herd the cats, the campus presidents, to talk about a system-wide set of interests and goals. Do you see that as reminding you of the early struggles, while at the same time, do you see an avenue for us to move forward and get our state and those who are constituent groups of SUNY to see it as a system?
It's my worst nightmare. As I, you know, I loved SUNY. I mean, I started out myopically devoted to Buffalo State. But when I got involved in the collective bargaining process, I began to appreciate the value of the system. We can lend lease to each other, which we don't do.
Right.
Now that we have technology that everybody except me can make work, we have opportunities to share. So I think that the union historically has been the major force holding the system together.
That's right.
I mean, people don't realize that, but it has been the one voice. SUNY doesn't lobby for itself. I know that's a bad word, but in fact, somebody has to speak for the system.
Yes.
And the union is the only one that does. And we have to emphasize that. I think the solution is what Sam Wachtel created and what I picked up on and developed. We need a cadre of people who become expert at communicating this message. And they have to do it in two directions. They have to do it to the legislature and the executive, of course, and they have to do it internally. So you got internal organizing that has to be done, but you also have outside education. We need a good public relations program. It can't be just in a time of crisis.
That's correct.
It has to be all the time. So I think collecting people who make this their major contribution to the union, 1%, 2% of their energies devoted to this. And besides, it's fun.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah.
I enjoy articulating the needs of my campus to people who can do something about it.
Correct. Absolutely. And I share your experience when I was on a negotiations team, how I became aware very quickly of the incredible work done across our union. And as president during a time when the SUNY hospitals have been under assault and then enduring a global pandemic, I rarely find the words to be able to express how deeply appreciative I am of their efforts to keep us safe.
When hasn't the hospitals been under assault?
Right.
The state views them as cash cows when, in fact, they're really black holes for money.
Yeah.
But we need them.
Absolutely.
I mean, my family doctor's retiring. If I don't find somebody, probably a graduate of SUNY, yeah,
exactly.
I'll be without a family doctor.
Yeah.
That's how important they are.
I want to close with some to get your thoughts on where the union movement stands, the labor movement, in an era where we're, you know, unions, the statistics don't lie. There's less than 10% of American workers unionized. It's always a repetitive thing that is said. And yet there seems to be more energy than there has been in a long time in terms of workers wanting to have unions. As to whether that translates into unionization, we'll see. And then specifically to UUP, we had the Janus decision, which meant an end to agency fee and a lot more pressure on all of us to organize and to develop strength that perhaps previously that kind of work didn't need to be done. And now it is an absolute necessity. So given your long experience, both as a scholar and as a union leader, where do you see unions going? Are you optimistic about our future?
Well, coming from Buffalo, which broke the ranks of Starbucks, four blocks from my house, I'm optimistic. But I think unions are going to have to develop a very different role than historically. The role is going to have to be policemen. We talk about a minimum wage of $50 an hour. We talk about health and safety precautions. Put them on the books. Who is going to enforce them? We talk about climate change that is affecting workers. Who is going to enforce the remedies? If there isn't a dispassionate committed with passion to enforcement, they'll just be observed in the breach. And the only remedy that I see is a revitalized labor movement. But this is a slightly different orientation from collective bargaining is.
Right.
But once you bargain something, or once you get this health and safety legislation on the books, how are you going to make sure that the buzzards don't just ignore it?
Right.
As they have done. Well, we have an underground economy in this country, which ignores Social Security, which ignores health and safety, and when somebody's hurt on the job, they're a non-person. They have no leg to stand on because they took the money under the table. You need unions to assume the responsibility and to get some of that underground economy above ground. So I see a real role if creative union leadership is willing to move in that direction, and I do see some of it. I mean, the Starbucks in Buffalo had 15 workers. Most unions are used to 47,000 workers.
Right.
But 15 workers deserve to have the minimum wage enforced, the health and safety regulations enforced, and so on. So unions are going to have to assume that responsibility because there's nobody else on the horizon to do it.
Right. Exactly.
So that I think, is what makes me optimistic.
I share your optimism. I'm by nature an optimist, but I think it's going to take work, especially during the time where we see
But Fred,
the politics of our nation.
But Fred, we are educators. This is going to take education.
Yes.
And we as educators have a responsibility to use the skills we develop in the classroom, in the larger classroom, which is our community.
Exactly.
But again, we have to assume that responsibility.
Last question. I was moving in this direction a little bit, but that role of educating in our communities, do you see that as a means by which we can overcome the terrible divides in our country where we don't seem to be able to talk to each other? I live in a very rural part of New York State where it is 100% Trump land. And everyone has a right to their own thoughts and their own philosophy, whatever. They vote for whomever they want. But there is this inability for communication or even an agreement on facts. Is that where we must play a role, as you said, as educators, as communicators?
Yes, I think that that focuses on it. But again, it's going to be limited to the community that we function in, but we have to develop the consciousness of responsibility. And I don't think enough of us do that.
Yeah.
Not enough of us do that.
And that's vitally important. Well, I want to thank you for taking the time to join us today on the first episode of The Voice. It has been a pleasure, and it has been, well, it's just been fun. So thank you, Nula, for joining us, and wish you all the best going forward.
Well, thank you for having me.
And now, here's three things to know. A Monmouth University poll shows that the issue of abortion has taken on much more importance as the midterm election approaches. The poll, issued May 12th, says 25% of adults see abortion rights as their prime issue when voting in upcoming congressional elections. That's up from 9% in 2018. The economy was just slightly ahead in the poll at 26%. The U.S. cannabis industry is expected to top $52 billion in annual sales by 2027, driven by legal marijuana in places like New York, Virginia, and Connecticut, according to Politico. The recreational market is $18.2 billion today and has an expected compound annual growth rate of 15.4% in the next 5 years, that according to a new report by cannabis analytics firm the Brightfield Group. Adult use sales are on track to double and should be over $37 billion by the end of 2027. Union organizing is on the upswing. The National Labor Relations Board reported a 57% increase in petitions for union recognition votes in the first half of fiscal 2022, which ended March 31st. There were 1,174 election petitions in those 6 months, compared to 748 in the equivalent 6 months from October 1st, 2020 to March 31st, 2021. And now, back to Fred for Kowal's Coda.
Thanks, Mike. I want to close this episode of The Voice. In fact, I'd like to do this at the end of every episode of The Voice with what I would refer to as kind of a recommendation, whether it's about music, movies, books, or the world we're experiencing today. This time, I want to recommend to you the May issue of The Atlantic, which consistently is a great thought-provoking read. This month, there is some incredibly timely coverage of those involved in a growing covert network preparing to circumvent restrictions on abortion rights. Also, a fascinating examination of the threats to the liberal world order that grow worse daily thanks to the action of the autocrats, written by the brilliant Ann Applebaum. And then there's a piece about Neshoba County, Mississippi, which I drove through recently. It's where in 1964, three civil rights workers were brutally murdered, and why it's not easy to find the locations of the events or memorials to the victims. Finally, there's a mind-blowing examination of the role of social media in undermining all of our institutions, such that our collective future as a democracy is threatened. And you know, the rising threat of authoritarianism and attacks on individual freedoms, and for that matter, attacks on democracy and voting rights, inspires me to close today with the words that Edward R. Murrow, who took on Joe McCarthy, used to close his broadcasts with. Good night and good luck.
The Voice podcast is a production of United University Professions. You can find UUP on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at UUP Info. UUP is on the web at UUPinfo.org. This episode was produced and directed by Mike Lisi, UUP's Director of Media and Publications. Thank you for listening.